Do you really believe that humans have successfully reverse engineered alien technology?
Yes, and I'll even go so far as to say recently I saw another Lockheed Martin video where they've now disclosed that they've begun to create metamaterial that can actually store and direct energy.
Can you imagine the amount of video content and evidence that they have locked behind closed doors? Video footage and like actual proof that these craft are actually transmedium?
Oh yeah, the late Harry Reid did say on an interview that not only have we only seen the tip of the iceberg, there is just much, much high resolution video that we'd probably never see the light of day.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Black Hole Theories. I am Patrick James, and I've got over here my co-host
Christian,
and this is Black Hole Theories. Today's episode, we got a really interesting guest. He is the author of the book UFO Science: Secret New Physics, Vehicles, and UAP. His name is G.O. Turner. I'm really excited about this interview. Christian over here arranged this, and this is our first time meeting him. But essentially, he is the author of this book where he's taken a lot of these classic stories that you may or may not have heard of, such as the New York Times release and confirmation of unidentified aerial phenomenon, and the Bob Lazar story where he apparently worked at Area 51 on a flying saucer that he referred to as the sports model. And what he's attempted to do in his book is simplify a lot of the physics around how these craft hypothetically work based on these whistleblower stories and try to break it down and see, is the physics of this actually possible, and actually presenting some of this physics in a way that's palatable for the general public like you, me, and Christian. So, Gary, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming on, man.
Hey, great to be here. I really appreciate the invite. That really hit the nail on the head. That is essentially, in a nutshell, the purpose of the book is to bring together all of these kind of different physics theories that have been very heady and mind-boggling and boil it down into something that everyday person could just pick up and leaf through and get a grasp on the science.
Yeah, 100%. And I know Christian probably has a ton of questions he wants to ask you, but I kind of want to get us started here, because one of the things that was really obvious to me as I was going through your book for the first time is that obviously the Bob Lazar craft really fascinated me, and the fact that you have a whole section just on the physics of that craft alone was fascinating, because one of the things I like to say to a lot of people, even Christian, is that I haven't necessarily been into the UFO rabbit hole for like decades like a lot of people. For me, when Bob Lazar came on Joe Rogan's podcast, I had obviously heard of this guy from the George Knapp reportings back in the 90s. But when he was on Joe Rogan and you could see it on video, that's where I really started to take this seriously. And so I'm curious, just to get us rolling here, what was the moment for you, or maybe the instance or the story that got you really starting to look into this seriously yourself?
My mind was fairly well blown back in 2017 with the New York Times article. I had previously read another text about the subject of life in the universe. And it was, I can't remember the title of it off the top of my head, but the subject was basically, when we look out into the universe, how come we don't see any signs of any technology anywhere we look? And it was a very objective examination of the topic. And at the end, the conclusion was basically that there was the likeliest possibility was that we as human beings might very well be the very first civilization in the universe, and that's why we don't see anything. I couldn't refute the evidence presented the way it was. And so for me, it kind of became a settled topic. And then years and years went by, and I thought, well, okay, UFOs aren't real. They're, you know, like all the other kind of paranormal things that you hear about. And I dismissed the topic until that article came out in 2017 and the footage was released from the Navy and other government agencies basically came out and said, yeah, this is actually a real thing. And it suddenly opened me back up that maybe this is a topic that I should re-examine. And the more I started digging into the new evidence and then going back and researching the physics surrounding it, the more I realized there's a lot more to it and I shouldn't have dismissed it from the beginning.
That makes a lot of sense. And was Bob Lazar's craft that he worked on, that whole gravity A, gravity B, gravity C waves, was that kind of one of the first ones that you really dove into yourself? Because I know it was like one of the major ones you highlighted in your book.
So yeah, the book actually features several different craft where I dedicate a chapter to each one. Now, the Bob Lazar case is the only one in the book that would be considered NHI. The rest of them are all man-made types of craft with the different theories surrounding them. Bob, like you, I saw the same Joe Rogan interview, and that started me down the Bob Lazar rabbit hole. And the more I dug, the more I realized there was a lot to it that was quite fascinating. I still, you know, kind of like, you know, there's lots of controversy around the man. But over time, I began to realize that people should probably just set aside the issue of how do you believe Bob or do you not believe Bob? For me, it's not about the man. Show me the data and let me examine the science. And then let's play with that. Let's see if we can objectively look at that and see if it is plausible or not. And discussing with other physicists, I began to realize the man might very well be onto something.
You know, when you say that, the thing that's always stood out to me about the Bob Lazar story is a lot of the stuff that he was saying when he was first coming out about this in the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of this stuff has recently been confirmed to be real physics. As an example, that everybody who's kind of been read into the story is obviously the element 115, which is kind of crucial to what he says is a key propulsion aspect to the craft. But here's another one that really fascinates me, and I think you might appreciate this given the fact that you kind of went into the gravity A, gravity B waves, kind of like he did in one of his earlier documentaries, is that gravity waves were not confirmed to be real until 2015, you know, and right. That was when, you know, the whole
LIGO,
right? They first, for the first time, recorded the gravity wave, but he was fully convinced and committed to the idea that this works on gravity wave propulsion. So the fact that he was saying that, what, 20 something years before gravity waves were confirmed to be the real cause of gravity and not a particle called a graviton, that one to me is even more compelling than element 115, which anybody who knows a little bit about the periodic table could go, oh yeah, an element 115 could theoretically exist. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. Of course, I think there was only, I can't remember exactly how many, it was 108 or something like that at the time when he made his conclusion. And of course the next person go, well, yeah, I can tack on seven more elements and just say it's 115.
Yeah.
And there's actually, there's another subject that they actually said was a totally different topic. The Betz sphere was supposedly studied by a physicist back in the 70s. And they concluded that there may very well be an element buried inside the Betz sphere that was like 140 on the elemental chart. But those are just kind of numbers you can throw out there.
I'm not aware of the Betz sphere. Can you bring me up to speed on what that is?
So that's touched on in the orbs chapter of the book.
Okay.
The Betz sphere came out in the 1970s, and there's a whole lore built around that. It's a fascinating topic. And it actually recently became relevant again when Ross Coulthard recently reported that he came across another individual that might have an identical sphere. And so he has been working with Professor Gary Nolan to possibly be able to dig into the science around that.
Interesting. Christian, feel free to chime in here anytime you want, man. Do you have any questions or thoughts on what we've been talking about so far?
Yeah, I actually have a lot of questions, and it's awesome that, you know, you're very well-rounded and informed as to like what's going on, you know, with UFOs. But I did want to ask you, when did you first really get invested into this whole topic of UFOs? What really like reignited you? Was it the New York Times story itself, or did you, you know, were you interested in the topic before that?
I was always fascinated by physics in general. I was such a science nerd going to college. I took several elective classes in physics, even though I was horrible at math. So for me, it was the topic of physics and the subject matter and the everything surrounding quantum mechanics and general relativity. That's what drew me in as a science nerd. And then seeing how this can all be applied to stuff that was told to us was completely impossible. I've always kept an open mind as a creative person. I really do feel that science needs that balance of creativity as well as the hard science and mathematics. Einstein will be probably one of the first people to tell you that creativity is probably the most vital part about science, because he imagined, you know, what it would be like to chase a light beam. And as a result, we have general relativity.
Yeah. That's crazy. I was just watching the Oppenheimer movie yesterday. So like, I've been literally thinking about Einstein basically since last night. So it's funny that you brought him up. Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm curious, can you explain the concept? Because I tried to explain this to Christian, and it's a little bit of a side tangent here. But like, can you describe the fact that light acts both as a particle and a wave at the same time? And it's like kind of trippy in that sense.
So no one has been able to really deduce how that could be yet. That's still one of the great mysteries in quantum mechanics. I can talk on the subject about the speed of light. And so, with the speed of light, everyone has generally accepted that it is impossible for other civilizations to be able to visit us on a realistic timescale, because to travel to our nearest star would literally take 4 years at the speed of light. But achieving the speed of light is 100% impossible. Einstein will tell you that. Because of mass and your interaction with the Higgs field, the faster you go, the more you interact with that Higgs field, and it requires more energy until you reach a relativistic speed where the amount of mass you take on to achieve that becomes nearly infinite. So clearly, you know, Einstein says that can't be done. And since that can't be done, of course, everyone can just, you know, wipe their hands and say, okay, there's no way that alien civilizations could plausibly do that without spending generations and generations to expand throughout the cosmos. But I feel that even Einstein would say that would be closed-minded thinking, that there might be other methods that don't exceed the speed of light where you could still make those achievements. And that's where we get into modifying the space-time continuum and generating our own gravity.
So this, I mean, this kind of brings into, I remember reading about this in your book, just the idea that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of where you're getting at, is that we're not thinking about how do they get from point A to point B. We're essentially thinking about warping space time to bring point B to us and just stepping over the divide. It's like wrinkling the space in between. Is that kind of what you're getting at with the propulsion system here?
Yeah, that you have varying degrees. There, as far as any physicist will tell you, there is no known limitation to how much you can compress space time. So you could compress the distance between where you want to be and where you are, and you will not violate the speed of light when you cross over that jump.
Yeah. Would you consider that?
Me wonder, like, are there other forms of propulsion that, you know, aren't gravity based? Makes me wonder.
I'm not aware of any other ones. The ones that are all featured in my book are gravity based. I understand there's, of course, some people have theories about wormholes and portals or interdimensional. And of course, some people understand that these NHI may very well be people from another period in our future. The interesting part about gravity-based travel, though, is if you can modify and compress space between A and B, well, because it's called space-time, you're also modifying time as well. And being able to manipulate time using a gravity engine explains a great deal about what is known as the five observables.
Yeah. And you know, this brings me to this question that I wanted to ask you. And you know, I just want to know your opinion. Do you lean more towards the belief that UFOs are actually extraterrestrials, or, you know, from another dimension that is outside of our reality? What's your take?
I leave that completely open. It could actually be all the above.
Yeah, that's what I think.
I mean, there's no reason to, if you look at, you know, your sci-fi, different genres in sci-fi, you'll see a kaleidoscope of different alien races and otherworldly, interdimensional everythings. And who's to say that whole kaleidoscope couldn't actually exist?
Would you consider that wrinkling of the space-time between point A and point B almost like, I mean, would you consider that basically the same concept as a wormhole? I mean, if you think about it, what that is you're essentially warping space-time to bring the two points as close as possible, right?
Well, with physical craft like this, they would modify... they would create their own subspace bubble, and then they could work independent of local space-time. And the way it is approached in the book is more as a gravity drive, where you essentially create a well of space-time that you can propel yourself through. The reports of like actual portals opening up in the air and seeing different backgrounds beyond that, that I wouldn't characterize as being part of a gravity drive. That would probably be more like your wormhole idea. But yeah, regardless, in some ways it has to have, I mean, it could be a wormhole, or who knows, it could be a opening to a parallel dimension. Who's to say?
Interesting.
But
I mean, would you
for the purpose
that-
of the physics... The purpose of the physics in this book was more about the craft, the vehicles, and the phenomena surrounding them.
Mm. Got it. So, I mean, when you create a gravity bubble and you can operate independent of the local space-time, kind of like what you were saying, in a way, is that almost like time travel in a sense where they're getting across these astronomical distances, essentially through a loop, a workaround of the speed limit of the universe, which is the speed of light, by warping space-time? Would you consider that a little bit time traveling to one degree, to where no time has elapsed when they've traversed this large amount of space? You see where I'm coming at?
Yes, absolutely. And even Bob Lazar has said that. So when one of the fascinating aspects about Bob Lazar's tale is, if you watch a lot of popular sci-fi, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and all the different kinds of sci-fi alien contact stories, everyone pretty much depicts flying saucers as like, you know, they zip along straight ahead. And that's been the general zeitgeist of the subject. But Bob was like, no, the craft I studied actually yeah, it can maneuver around like your typical flying saucer when it needs to. The funny part is when it kind of comes to a hovering stop, it seems really unstable and it tends to wobble around. But when it wants to go intergalactic or other solar systems, it will pivot its belly up to where it wants to go and then fly towards its object bottom first. And I found that fascinating. And there was no other examples of that until 2017, when they started to show the gimbal video. And the interesting aspect about that IR video was the gimbal begins to rotate up, and then we see the end of the video. And the rest of it was considered too classified to release. Would that be because they didn't want to show this crap suddenly zipping away belly first?
If that happened, I feel like that would have been basically confirmation that this thing defies the laws of physics. I think even when we look at something like the Tic Tac video, it does show it zipping off. But for the general public who don't know, who don't think about like, well, when it's zipping off and it's breaking the lock there, it's actually going thousands of miles an hour. I think most people go, oh, it kind of slightly went to the left slowly, you know, but if we saw that thing breaking like at breakneck speed zip off on the rest of the gimbal video, I think that would have had people really alarmed it in possibly a good way and possibly a bad way.
Yeah. And as that Tic Tac is zipping away, of course, the camera gimbal is trying to keep up with it. So on the camera, it doesn't seem as fast, but if you have it in relation to like the horizon on in the sky,
yeah,
that's quite speedy.
Yeah. I was wondering this just be, I'm sorry, Christian, you can ask it right.
No, I was just going to, yeah. I was just going to say, like, can you imagine the amount of video content and evidence that they have locked behind closed doors? I mean, you know, video footage and like actual proof that these craft are actually transmedium and are able to zip through the space, air, and sea. I mean,
Oh yeah. The late Harry Reid did say on an interview that not only have we only seen the tip of the iceberg, there is just, he's aware of much, much high resolution video that he felt before he passed we'd probably never see the light of day. There have been other small videos. There was a, what do you call it? One of those razor phone videos that came out of Brazil where a construction worker happened to just whip his little razor phone out and captured a small disc in the distance. And it suddenly goes into this wild gyration where it flips up to its belly and then it's gone.
Yeah, we need that video.
So the same type of motion as what you were saying with the sport model, right?
Right. So that lends a lot of credence to what Bob was saying. Also, the fact that the description of it as wobbling when it is in low speed or hovering. Mm-hmm. I explain in the book with the three gravity emitters placed underneath the craft in the position they are. If you're applying two of those emitters to counteract the gravity of the Earth and you're using the other emitter to kind of propel yourself around in the space, well, having two off-centered emitters is going to create a natural wobble at slow speeds.
That makes sense. I'm curious, when it creates that gravity bubble around the craft where, like you said, it kind of can operate independent of the space around it. And I think you even showed illustrations to where it could, if that's how it works, then it could also theoretically cloak itself. Like it warps light around to go around it to where it looks see-through. It's invisible.
Exactly.
With that, I'm curious, because this is the one thing that always, like, I've secretly wondered is, even if it could zip from point A to point B really quickly, and people think it's just like literally going from point A to point B really fast. The problem with that was always like, let's say they're going interstellar, you know, how do they not hit like random comets along the way? And
that's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
But I guess the question I ultimately have is, if it forms its own bubble completely surrounding itself, would that also make it to where matter things that have mass would also warp around it just like the light. So it's literally you pass through it too.
Yeah, I could definitely imagine that with its own. That's why I know the Ryan Graves has his. We're able to take the subject and talk about how it is a threat to aviation to have these objects around in space. But and depending on what level of distortion you have around your vehicle will determine. So, yeah, if you have a high warp distortion around your vehicle, you'll probably slide past anything. Which also explains why they're able to go from space through the air and then slip right into the water without a splash.
Yeah.
I remember reading somewhere also, yeah. Sorry to cut you off, Patrick, but just real quick, I want your guys' take on it. But like, I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that Bob Lazar or some whistleblower came out and actually said that, or, you know, he alleged that a lot of these craft are controlled through telepathy or, you know, through telepathic communication. Is that the general consensus here for how these craft operate?
So, yeah, Bob's sport model, from what I understand, it did require that. Also, my understanding is also some of these orbs also function in that same way. The fascinating part in the orb chapter I lightly touch on was some of the back engineering attempts on these orbs basically concluded that they couldn't find any mechanisms within the orb, which led them to conclude that somehow these orbs are being consciously driven, not just steered, but actually maneuvered consciously.
Wow.
So it's the conclusion that it could be driven consciously. Is that just based off of the circumstantial evidence that that's the only plausible explanation they can come up with based on just not recognizing any perceivable technology in there?
Well, if I ever sit down and have lunch with one of these legacy physicists, I'll be sure to ask them that.
What? So one thing I also noticed in your book, and this is no knock on your writing, because I think your recollection of everything is so detailed and so great. But the thing that always stood out to me, and I ran into this when I would try to tell people about the Bob Lazar story, is when I'm trying to describe how this craft theoretically worked based off of Bob Lazar's explanation, what always confused me is I understood how the element 115 would get hit with a proton. It would go up to element 116, radioactively decay. It would give off antimatter, and there would be an antimatter reaction, which to me, okay, I get it up to that point, and it's a ginormous explosion. Like antimatter, I guess what I'm thinking of is like it's a nuclear explosion times 1,000 or something like that, right?
Right, but, right.
But what didn't make sense to me is how do you convert an antimatter ginormous amount of energy explosion into
energy.
Gravity, into gravity warping? How does that, what's the connection there?
There is no connection.
Mm.
So that's one of the aspects of the sport model is it is a gravity driven vehicle that uses the element 115 directly. It amplifies that gravity A wave to drive it throughout the universe. But as for the antimatter reaction, that's actually secondary to the gravity A wave. It provides power to the craft for other functions. So it's basically the battery for the craft. But and then it's a really fascinating aspect of it. I have a depiction of how that reactor works. But of course, at the point of the matter antimatter reaction, you have an enormous amount of power. Where does all that power go? You know, is the metamaterial hull of the craft acting as some kind of battery? And does it absorb that power and then just, you know, how often does that reaction, is it required? How often does that single particle have to be fired off? That's one question I would love to know. Is this just stored in the hull of the craft as energy for use later? And maybe it only fires off once an hour, or who knows how often, or once a year. Because there's such a huge amount of power that is generated from a matter-antimatter reaction.
So you're telling me, and this is, I guess, maybe highlighting something that I maybe misunderstood from the original story even. So you're telling me that that whole decay of element 116 to 115 and matter, antimatter, that whole reaction has nothing to do with the actual propulsion of the craft. That's just secondary power to the craft.
Exactly.
So then what's the, because I thought element 115 was crucial for the gravity manipulation. No.
The element 115 actually generates the gravity just natively.
Oh, because it has so much mass?
So the way it was understood was, it was such a dense element on the periodic chart that once you got up to element 115, what Bob calls gravity A and gravity B, gravity B being the natural form of gravity that we are all familiar with like planets and stars, etc. Gravity A to Bob is what we would also call the strong nuclear force. Now, that is the quantum force that holds quarks together to form protons, and then it holds protons and neutrons together to form nuclei. So once this has always been considered a physical force that exists only on a subatomic level. But with element 115, the strong nuclear force becomes so powerful that its influence, its sphere of influence, actually expands out beyond the radius of the atom itself, to a full inch beyond that atom of element 115. Now, if you take a purified ingot of element 115 and you mill it in this very particular method that is demonstrated in the book, you get this cascading wave of gravity or the strong nuclear force. Because when it expands outside of the atom, it seems to have an inverse reaction of gravity. So it actually forms like anti-gravity. And they're able to siphon this off because of the particular wavelength that it is emitted, the gravity A wave.
Hmm.
And so the engine takes that siphoned off gravity A wave, and using a waveguide, it funnels it through a amplifier, very similar to the kind that we would use for power amplification from electric engines or power grids. And then doubling up those A waves upon each other, they can magnify and then redirect those waves where the craft needs to be driven.
Yeah. So I guess one of the things about element 115, and my mind is kind of like questioning everything now, because I feel like, man, I didn't make that connection as far as like the element 115, the whole firing the proton at it, the antimatter had nothing to do with the propulsion. That's right, kind of mind blowing for me.
Yeah, those are separate functions.
So one of the things that about element 115, I'm curious, because you said it was essentially creating its own gravity that was more than expected, I guess, right? When element 115 was confirmed to be physically possible by, 2004, when they got it and it radioactively decayed instantly, but it was just a split second that they got it to exist in that particle accelerator. Did they notice the same effects on gravity from that one experiment, or was it not around long enough for them to measure any gravity warping.
Well, it isn't just a problem. You could ask any quantum scientist out there. Connecting gravity to anything subatomic is nearly impossible. And then you compound it by having an element that only exists for a hundredth of a second. And its detection was probably inferred anyway, not directly observed, because you have different plates on the outside of your particle collider that basically register hits. And so, you know, it's not directly observed, but through the math and through inference, they determined that, yes, we did create element 115 for that fraction of a second. But it just isn't possible for them to detect any kind of relation to gravity, especially under the enormous forces of a particle collider.
Hmm. Interesting. I did want to make one correction. I believe gravity is the weakest of the nuclear forces, technically.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, it is enormously weak.
Yeah. Christian, you have any questions? I feel like we're kind of just... I don't want to cut you out of the conversation.
No, man. Listen. I'm a resident idiot when it comes down to all this science stuff. So, man, I really like to hear about it and learn more. You know, I'm just like an outsider looking in. And this, you know, for this conversation you guys have had so far. But something, you know, I want to ask a more broad question, if you don't mind. And it's more of like your take, because your book outlines a lot of like the craft and, you know, the technology, how they work, all the little micro details of the UFO craft, right? And so I wanted to ask you, do you really believe that humans have successfully reverse engineered alien technology?
Yes, and I'll even go so far as to say recently, I saw another Lockheed Martin video where they've now disclosed that they've begun to create metamaterial that can actually store and direct energy. So like one of the facets of Bob Lazar's sport model is that the entire craft, throughout that craft, there are no wires, nothing that was obvious that would be a way to distribute energy around. And they were mystified at how that could be. And now, lo and behold, Lockheed Martin is starting to develop metamaterials that can distribute energy and direct information through these different things without a single wire.
Wow. Yeah, I know a lot of, there's a lot of speculation that a lot of these craft are kind of like 3D printed.
Yeah. So that's the biggest limitation with our back engineering attempts, is we don't have the capabilities to create metamaterials on this atomic level. We create metamaterials on above molecular level, where we're just kind of merging different alloys and different elements together with alloys into lattices. And we're seeing some amazing results from those new metamaterials. Which, by the way, when Bob Lazar came out in 1989, no one had ever heard the term metamaterial before. It wasn't until either 1999 or the year 2000 when that term even came into existence.
Hmm. So he kind of coined the term. Interesting.
Well, no, he didn't coin the term.
No.
Okay. But he just couldn't explain. He just said, I have no idea why this thing does what it does, because I can't find any wires in there. One thing he laughed about was, out of everything in that craft, the only thing he fully completely understood was this little hatch in the floor of the vehicle.
Right. Yeah. It's all very interesting. Did it have any seats? From my recollection, I believe there were seats as well in the craft.
Yeah, there were three seats.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very,
you would probably need to be a first grader in order to fit comfortably in those.
Right. And that implies that these, you know, whoever occupied these craft are bipedal, right? I mean, in order to sit on something, I mean, you got to have at least like two legs or something. I don't know. That's just my perspective. Yeah. Let me ask you, do you think that NASA is suppressing many of these technologies? And do you think that they have gone to great lengths to keep this information private, if you know what I mean?
I haven't really delved into the forensics of some of the stuff that NASA's done, but I understand that people have put forward that a lot of photographic evidence have been manipulated, and they've shown signs of just simple cloning where, like one section of the photograph is a perfect identical copy of another section of the photograph. Why would you Photoshop something out in a lunar landscape?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really curious. Sorry, I want to go back to the Bob Lazar craft. I'm really curious. Do you believe, because based on what we're hearing about Element 115, and it could just, I'm just curious, like Element 115 is obviously an engineering choice made by whatever created this thing, right? But just like humans make engineering choices, you could make something out of aluminum or out of steel, right? It's an engineering choice based off of whatever logic or budget or whatever.
Right. Do you functionality. Think
functionality, right? So putting ourselves potentially in the frame of mind of whatever might've created this thing. I mean, from the sounds of the way we're describing it, it sounds like this thing is a super machine. It can travel from point A to point B instantaneously anywhere in the universe. I mean, if that's the case, it's basically like like one of those stones in the Avengers movies where it's like you can control like laws of physics, right? So I'm curious, are there any inherent limitations of
Element 115? So one of the things I posit in the book that I found interesting, just doing some simple if-then statements in your head about the data as you understand it, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's such a super vehicle as one of the fascinating aspects about the sport model is there's no bathrooms. There's no places for food storage. Mm. So essentially what you're looking at is a car. If you run under the assumption that the occupants of this craft are living beings that consume sustenance and create waste, then you're looking at a vehicle that you're only going to be in for a few hours at most. I mean, there are some exceptions. I mean, if the occupants are instead, artificial intelligence or avatars, then yeah, they wouldn't require bathrooms and food and things like that. But I want to lend myself more towards you're looking at a car and not so much an interstellar craft. So if it's not an interstellar craft, then it probably meets up somewhere else or has some jump point of some kind.
That makes me wonder, have they ever recovered a craft where there's purported bathrooms or food or, any kind of like normalized or, what we would perceive as normal, amenities or, technology?
So recently, David Grush gave a speech in New York. I want to say that was around New Year's. And maybe you heard about where he disclosed that supposedly one of the weapons manufacturers, military manufacturers, is in possession of a 40-foot diameter craft, which is the size of a football field inside.
Yeah.
So hopefully those would have some kind of bathroom.
Did you hear about that, Patrick?
Yeah, I have heard about that. I have a question. I mean, so real quick, I guess this would change my question. What do you think cause you might've said this, but what do you think the reason is for all the energy created out of the antimatter reaction? Like did they ever find a purpose of where that energy goes to? If it's not the gravity?
No, that was not really discussed. It is a fascinating question. Yeah. And again, it goes back to why would you need that much power?
Right. Yeah.
Because so much of his understanding of the gravity aspect of the sport model It could even be weaponized, where you could create gravity lenses to fire beams through to for concentrated energy. Now, maybe that might be one of the alternative purposes. How much of the energy is required to operate whatever computational energy it takes to navigate the vehicle? Who knows?
Yeah. What if the result of the antimatter reaction actually allows the aliens to get really extremely high? Like, it's like the sonar aliens, like, hey dude, you want to go over to Earth and watch the humans real quick? And they actually get like really stoned off the antimatter reaction, and then the gravity stuff is separate. It's like you said, driving a car.
I've seen a vacuum cleaner like that on heavy metal.
What do you think, Christian? You ever been high?
Many times, both physically and not. Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, Christian, actually, when you were asking that question about like the bathrooms and stuff,
yeah,
I don't know if you've ever heard about this story, Gio, but I vaguely remember a story about a UFO sighting where beings came out and essentially gave this guy, this farmer or whatever, like food. And the food, he had a piece of it. He was showing it on like this interview.
Yeah. And the pancake, like, right?
It was like this weird cracker thing that kind of tasted like just pure fiber.
Yeah, I remember that story. Yeah. Have you heard about that, Gio?
That one I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, he actually ate the pancake. I think he called it a pancake. And
he hopefully saved some for somebody to study.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wasted opportunity.
I mean, that's crazy. If you gave me some alien food, I'm telling you, I'm not sticking that in my mouth. I'm just, like, who knows what's on it? You know what I'm saying?
And honestly, you really shouldn't, because it's like one of the issues. So some people definitely theorize that these gray aliens are actually artificially intelligent biologic androids.
Yeah.
And the reason you would employ them is because very much, you know, when you go to visit other planets, are you going to pop your helmet right off and start breathing in the atmosphere? Of course not.
Right. That's a liability.
It's a huge liability. There's bacteria, there's viruses. Who knows, you know, what could happen to you outside of the different, you know, atmosphere mixtures.
Right. Yeah. So, for both the planet and for the invaders. Yeah.
So better to send down sterile androids that could possibly interact with human and not bring back anything as well that you don't want.
Right. This reminds me of Moment of Contact, of the Virginia creature that infected that cop.
Right.
The cop recovered like this alien being, and he ended up dying of just unknown causes, and the whole hospital that he was brought to had to be quarantined. In James Fox's film Moment of Contact, really good movie. Have you seen it, Gio?
Oh yes, I followed that case as well. And of course, they buried his body as quickly as they could, because they understood that nothing they threw at the bacteria that had infested his body, nothing they threw at it had any effect.
Yeah. I have a question for you guys, and this is really interesting that you brought this up, Christian. So Gio, yes, I told you that yesterday I was in New York for a podcast. It was exciting. I actually did shout out our podcast, Black Hole Theories, Christian.
Nice.
But it was literally so recent that I haven't even told Christian about this, Gio. But so here's the thing. The producer of this podcast, his name is Alessi. And he actually was the cameraman for James Fox in the Virginia, Brazil Moment of Contact when they were filming that.
He was the one that approached that guy that was very hesitant. Like, and he was like about to shoot them in that movie.
He was holding the camera, and he was doing the camera holding for the whole, like all the interviews that they did and everything. He was the, so that's long story short, I want to get your guys' take on this, because he gave me a ride to the airport last night. And obviously we were talking, and by that point I'd been hanging out with this guy for 5-6 hours, but this is like first time it's like just me and him, and I'm asking him all the questions I have about this documentary being, and him being down there. And one of the things that stood out to me is like, okay, how can anybody be skeptical that this is a real thing and that they're, that aliens are real, if these people actually physically saw this little creature like they talk about in this documentary? Like, wouldn't that alone be enough to just convince you that this is real, especially if this is, if the documentary proves that this thing actually happened? And I basically posited that question to the guy who was there filming with James Fox. Because he said, like, they even went out and grabbed beers with the guy who was in the car. The, I forget the name of the guy, but they, like, James is like making a big deal. He's like, I looked at this man in the eyes and realized that this man has seen an alien creature and it gave me chills. Like, that's kind of what my impression of James. He's like, yeah, we went out and grabbed beers with this guy afterwards. And I was like, well, did you guys continue talking about the alien? He's like, yeah, of course, man. So I was like, I asked him this question, right? And the cameraman goes, yeah, I don't know, I'm still a little skeptical. The fuck? So I really wanted to ask you guys, what do you make of that? Because do you see my logic, and do you see how now that kind of throws a wrench in the whole thing?
Of course. I mean, the whole town knew about the incident. The whole town was being quarantined and like sectioned off in corners. I don't know, Gary, what are your thoughts?
I mean, there is something to be said for people want to glom onto an exciting story and play their role. And especially when you're talking about, you know, other countries where it's just a fascinating topic and people want to be a part of. So I try to avoid any kind of fixation on individuals as to whether or not this person is to be believed or that person to be believed. I would much rather just focus on the data and study the theories and talk with other physicists.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I could see that perspective. And this brings me to this question, okay? And so have you ever heard of the Wilson memo?
Yes.
Do you believe it's authentic?
I think there is plenty of reason to find that acceptable.
Okay. So in the Wilson memo, they discuss how there hasn't been any progress in reverse engineering the technology. And the Wilson memo, it was actually recorded in the 90s, right? In the early 90s. So that poses my question to you, and I want to get your take on this, is have we made advancements from the 1990s to today, right? If there's validity to the Wilson memo in that, you know, there hasn't been any advancements.
So you have to, it's kind of, there's so many different aspects to view this from. So from the aspect of that particular military contractor, they didn't want to divulge more than they needed to. Their whole purpose for having that meeting was to find out how the J2 found out about their existence. So they're only going to disclose what they feel like they need to, and anything else they can always just kind of we haven't gotten anywhere with it yet,
right?
But yeah, we've got stuff because you're aware that we have stuff, so we're not going to deny that, but oh no, we haven't gotten anywhere with it yet.
So you think it was being like obfuscated even in the memo?
Right, they didn't want him to, they never let him in to see anything.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, the whole purpose of that meeting was it wasn't just to shut him down. It was because they wanted to meet with him because they wanted to know who led them to their door.
Hmm. I see. That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah,
I have a question. Speaking of documents, have you heard of the Nazi wonder weapons, specifically things like Die Glock or the Hanabu craft, which looks like flying saucers, the blueprints of these things that were found?
Yeah, so that was thrown out to me when I was studying all these different vehicles. And I seriously considered like, well, okay, I want to feature one of these Nazi flying saucers within this book since I'm featuring all these other craft. I'm mm-hmm. featuring the Fluxliner. The TR-3B, as well as Salvatore Pius's his Navy patents. And of course, it's like, well, I definitely should also speak on the topic of the Nazi UFOs, the flying saucers. But the more I dug into that background, the less physics I found. So there was very little about it. It all just seems to be kind of lore-based and rumor-based.
Yeah.
So without the physics, I really couldn't talk on the subject.
Well, here's what's interesting about, you know, even you just saying that is because I felt... I almost to a degree disagree, but maybe I'm a bro physicist. I'm not like a scientist by any means. Like I was pre-med. So I took all the science classes. I got into dental school, but my favorite class was like organic chemistry. I also loved physics. So I'm kind of a nerd, but I'm a bro at the same time, right? But what stood out to me, yeah, what stood out to me is like something like Die Glock, which they say could have been maybe even the core propulsion system for the Hanabu craft in itself. But Die Glock, the physics around that, I'm sure maybe you've heard of this. They say it literally had to do with sending an electrical charge through a centrifuge that had what they called red mercury spinning at a high rate. Have you heard about this?
So yeah, it's similar to what is proposed with the Fluxliner, as well as the TR-3B and
exactly the TR-3B the, was the connection
mass
that I made
reduction
too.
Vehicle.
Okay.
So the we've talked a lot about the sport model, and that is the one NHI vehicle in the craft. The others are more of the back engineering attempts, and for those. The sport model uses an elegant design and has its own remarkable fuel source, Element 115. All the man-made craft use a brute force tactic to achieve similar results. And that really delves down into the quantum mechanics. Salvatore Pius is a phenomenal physicist and remarkable man who has developed many real technologies that are now currently employed by the U.S. Navy. He has developed hypersonic torpedoes. So understand that. These are torpedoes that can travel faster than the speed of sound underwater. And this man has developed his own particular kind of flying saucer, not really a saucer so much as a diamond-shaped vehicle. But what he attempts to do is brute force the type of, so we want to create our own artificial gravity. And the method that he employs is a brute force method similar to creating the power of a star with inside the craft. So we all understand that if you want to bend gravity around to the level of a planet like Jupiter, you need a Jupiter-sized planet to create that much distortion in gravity. Salvatore has worked out a way of using high energy materials and initially, his patents were rejected because it was felt that the power levels required to achieve it were on par with a neutron star. And that is just a ridiculously mind-boggling amount of power. But Salvatore worked out a way using rotation and vibration where he could achieve the same or similar power outputs in order to modify the vacuum of space. Now, the great part about having a book like mine is I have illustrations all throughout where I break down how this is achieved. But basically, all these different man-made vehicles manipulate what we call the quantum foam. And through that manipulation, we can modify the curvature of space-time. And I left you guys breathless now, right?
Yeah.
I've been breathless this entire time. So
but that's why it's in a book with illustrations, so it's easier to understand.
I love it. I'm looking at it right now, and there's a lot of illustration, and I feel like a lot of people need that, especially those that are just diving into the topic, or just, you know, just casually reading it, and they want to get a better understanding of, you know, what this is, how it works. I feel like visuals are definitely a plus for sure. Yeah.
And really, my whole point in creating this book is to break apart that stigma that we've all been living with for 80 years. We've been told that the physics says it's impossible. But if you can sit down and it's actually a relatively short book, it's only about 150 pages with illustrations and everything. But if you can sit down and you can examine the illustrations and read through the text, you can begin to grasp that what we've been told is absolutely not true. This is possible, and we need to open our minds a bit to what is potentially a game changer.
Yeah.
Amen to that. And that leads me to a quick question for you. And I don't know how much time you have left, Gio, so I want to be considerate of your time. But one thing that did stick out to me, I believe it was like last year, the year before that, is that there's this retired CIA officer who's, you know, been on several podcasts online on YouTube. His name is John Ramirez, and he's essentially just kind of blowing the whistle about there being a timeline for disclosure, and a number or a year that he threw out was 2027. And
yes, I actually touch on that towards the conjecture part of my book.
Gotcha. What are your thoughts on that, on there being an actual plotted disclosure? And what does he mean by, you know, that we have until, you know, 2027, that, you know, I don't know if that implies that there's something that's coming here or something that will be revealed to the public. What's your take?
So retired CIA operative John Ramirez basically came on and said the whole point of the 2017 article was to start us down a path that we had a 10-year roadmap to follow, and that by the year 2027, some thing would occur, some event would happen, that disclosure would become inevitable and undeniable. So basically, the governments have this 10 years to kind of bring the rest of the world up to speed, because if they say nothing and then the disclosure happens dramatically, there'd be a lot of hell to pay. So that is his consensus on the subject. The fascinating part is John was a very high-ranking individual within the CIA. And he was able to speak on this subject because he never signed an NDA relating to the topic of UAP. And he heard in classified settings and in different SCIF meetings that this is actually something that the CIA is discussing. It would be a fascinating event to look forward to, but I can't say one way or the other.
Yeah. It is very interesting. Yeah. Patrick, did you have any other questions for him?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of... even bringing it back to a little bit of the original reason I asked about the Nazi wonder weapons was because I did want to work it back to the TR-3B. The first time I heard about the TR-3B was when Tom DeLonge brought it up on Joe Rogan's podcast, a little video, and Joe Rogan said it looked like bullshit. But, you know, I searched the TR-3B and found something interesting when you Google the TR-3B Ad Astra, is that there's an actual patent on Google for it. I'm curious, what do you make of the fact that, I mean, doesn't that, if there's an actual like approved patent for this thing that you can find with a quick Google search, is that basically just confirmation that we have craft that operate on physics that we didn't realize that we could do of warping of gravity?
I'm not sure when that was published. I never came across that patent during my research. I definitely, I have a chapter dedicated to the craft, but The science that I was presented, I actually had difficulty with. And I honestly refuted some of the information that was in there in that particular theory. Mm. The topic is so thoroughly seeded with disinformation. I'm actually working on a second book in the series right now and weeding through all that disinformation and trying to separate fact from fiction is quite difficult. But there's so many different descriptions of the TR-3B. One describes it as the size of an aircraft carrier. Another one is saying it's more like a fighter jet size. I mean, it's possible there could be multiple versions of it. Who's to say?
So I'm curious, how do you discern between disinformation and potentially true information? And I say potentially because it almost seems like until any of this is actually confirmed, it's anybody's guess on what's real and what's not, you know?
Well, that's where the disinformation really tends to focus on discrediting people. It's far easier to discredit people. And my research, I just focus on the data and the science. Present to me a theory and we'll sit down with other physicists and we'll examine that evidence and see if it's plausible or not. So like with the particular TR-3B theory that was put forward, it involved high energy plasma, but then it also referred to using sub-zero temperatures. And typically that's like saying we're going to take fire and we're going to freeze it. That generally doesn't work out all that well, but I have spoken with other physicists since the book has been published, and there has been some information that was kind of bandied my way that was about how with superconductors and you have things that are called Cooper pairs where the electron is able to pass through these different meshes and that way you can have superconductivity. So they're not necessarily tied and repelling each other, which if you're talking about free floating ions that are at a sub-zero temperature, I guess technically that's still a plasma, but it's just not one I'm familiar with.
Mm. What do you make of string theory? Do you believe it's the most accurate theory to explain the reality we live in?
I think the credence behind string theory is starting to break away. There are now other theories coming out that are separate from that. Eric Weinstein has his theories. And of course, anyone who watches the Toe podcast understands that there are several different theories of everything coming together. There is a section in my book on conjecture where it was possibly thrown out that maybe string theory was a red herring that might have been put out as a way to distract from other sciences.
Hmm. That makes sense. I'm curious, you know, and these are just random questions that I really feel the need to ask because I'm just a creative and curious person, I guess. But have you ever thought about what consciousness is and like where it comes from?
Well, that's definitely the greatest mystery of all. You know, we have the two great mysteries. Are we alone in the universe? And what happens to us after we die? And from what I understand, this particular topic actually could relate to answering both.
Yeah.
I'm currently working on my second book, which is related to the topic of crop circles. The book I'd like to work on next in the UFO Science series, I'm calling it The Skeptic's Guide to the Woo. And when I get into that one, we'll be definitely touching on the topic of consciousness, etc.
So are you a skeptic of consciousness?
I'm a skeptic of a lot of things. Good science has skepticism.
True. What do you make of Neil deGrasse Tyson's utter skepticism, so much so to where he doesn't even want to look that direction of UFOs and extraterrestrials?
I want to say a big thank you to Neil deGrasse Tyson, because you stepping aside is now allowing other people to come in and fill the role that you traditionally mastered.
He steps aside?
Well, his stepping aside and saying, I'm really not going to try and be the layman. I'm not going to be the science interpreter on this subject. So because Neil basically doesn't want to go near the topic, that opened up the door for me that I'm happy to go ahead and step in and try and help people understand the science in this particular field.
Yeah. I mean, would you consider yourself more on the theoretical side of physics then?
Well, we are studying, this book does cover those theories. Yeah. So it is, everything in the book is theoretical. And we examine those theories in detail and say, is it plausible or not? And then I present it to the readers to decide for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think that's kind of why, like Michio Kaku, like one of the most famous theoretical physicists, right? He, you know, I think everybody loves to understand some of what is potentially possible. And I think the way you've kind of bridged the gap with your book really does, especially with the illustrations, which are so great, make it palatable for the general bro physicist like myself to try to understand how this stuff might work, you know?
Just to backtrack just for a minute on Bob Lazar. Yeah. I think what really triggered me to write this book was when I came across the physicist Ricardo Sciorti. So Bob put forward his whole theory about how the sport model worked. And all along the way, he kept espousing, I don't know how this part works. I don't know why this is the way it is. I don't know why this particular thing needs to be at this frequency, or why element 115 has to be machined in this manner. So Ricardo, coming from a different field within physics, was able to fill in those I don't know why blanks. So to me, that lends a huge amount of credence to someone who is testifying on the science of something when they present information that is accurate, but they don't know why it's accurate. If you're going to manufacture and make up things, if you're just going to, you know, hoax everybody, you're not going to come up with some extraordinarily detailed number of frequency and then have it accidentally be correct.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from.
So the second half of the Bob Lazar chapter in my book talks on the how Ricardo Sciorti was able to accurately pin down all those things that Bob didn't understand. Food for thought.
That's interesting. Yeah. Christian, any questions?
Yeah. Like I said, you guys are circling back to the techie stuff, to the science stuff.
Yeah. All right. So if someone wants to find your book or even follow you on social media, where do you recommend they go?
It's available as paperback in many different bookstores, you know, Barnes & Noble or Apple Books, et cetera. It's also Amazon has it in ebook, hardback, and as well as Kindle Unlimited.
Okay.
Awesome. Cool. Awesome. I actually have one last question for you, and this might be newsworthy or relevant. And you know, I just wanted to, you know, get your perspective on this, right? And I'm sure you've heard of it. It's been on the news. So what are your thoughts on why China is purchasing land near military installations in the United States?
Oh yeah, I heard recently that China bought up all the land surrounding Area 51.
Where they're testing out stealth bombers and, you know, probably a lot of these exotic technologies, right, that are being allegedly reverse engineered.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting thing. I'm surprised, like, I have to wonder. I think our American intelligence agencies are pretty damn smart. And they were actually quite happy that China flew their giant balloon over our country, because it actually afforded America an opportunity to signal trace everything that was coming and going from that balloon. That's why they didn't shoot it down until it had completed what it was going to do. Because one, they knew it wasn't going to find anything of interest, because all of the missile silos it was flying over were closed. And it was just China. If you listen to Peter Zeihan, China is making some rather interesting decisions about how they choose to do things.
Yeah, very strategic in a weird way. Yeah.
I'm sure the U.S. government would have an issue with them buying up all the land around Area 51 if they thought it was a problem.
Is that considered like a modern day invasion? Like maybe in 2024, wars are not fought with guns, but they're fought with buying land in other countries. Like, could it get to the point where China owns most of the U.S. and the U.S. owns most of China? How crazy would that be?
Well, you have the start of a great fiction novel you could go for there.
I mean, it sounds like they're invading us just using our own rules.
Yeah.
Well, I do love to travel. I get out quite a bit, and especially when I'm out writing. And the interesting thing I find is the more I go to other countries. I recently just went to Vietnam. And there you have a there you have a communist society, but I'm sorry to say, Vietnam is as capitalist as they come. There's so much advertising, and you know, people are making money and running businesses. The big difference is, of course, you have a one-party government system. So capitalism is really, it's a separate thing from how we govern each other.
Do you think that an alien civilization, if these craft were supposedly from another world, do you think that they would be products of capitalism? Like, what if those people are just here doing their job? It's like, all right, got to pay the fucking bills. Let me go on another trip to Earth, and I'll be back home by dinner time.
Well, I'd like to imagine they're a little more like Star Trek, where, you know, economic viability isn't so much an issue in the future, and it's more about intellectual stimulation. I'll throw a question to you instead before I head out. There's one thing that I find interesting that no one seems to be discussing about NHI, and that is, if they are telepaths, as we come to understand they are, if you could sit down across from them and ask them to show you their artwork, their music, what do you think that would be like? Because having telepathy is something we don't have, and look what we achieved without it.
Do you think we don't have telepathy?
Well, most of us don't.
What is that thing where you feel like someone's staring at you? And 99.9% of the time, someone is staring at you when you get that feeling. Do you think that's like a form of telepathy?
Potentially, but I've actually seen studies where that's been refuted.
Really?
Yeah, there's actually been some videos on that topic where, imagine you're standing in a TV studio and there's a curtain behind you, okay? Mm. And behind that curtain is a window that is either filled with people staring at you or not. Okay. So they ran a series of tests with all these different individuals that would come in, and some people had someone staring at them and some people didn't. And they would part the curtains to reveal whether or not this was the case. And they found that there was absolutely no accuracy between those people who thought they were being stared at and those that did.
So wait, was the curtain in between the staring people and the subject?
So the subject would come into the room, the curtains would be closed, and the person wouldn't be told whether or not they felt like they were being stared at first. And then finally they would have some discussion, and then the interviewer would ask, do you feel like a bunch of people are staring at you? And some people would say yes, some people would say no. Then they would part the curtains and you would either see an empty room or a room filled with people.
Yeah. That makes sense. I guess, let me ask you this then, because we all know that science gets a little weird, especially when we get theoretical on something like telepathy. Because what if it is similar to the observer effect on exactly the question I asked you? Why is it that sometimes light acts like a particle and like a wave? And if you've seen like the slit experiment, the whole concept of it is just the fact that you add an observer changes how it manifests in itself. So what if that has something similar to do with that effect that we're hypothesizing right now of noticing someone staring at you?
Definitely that is one of the big mysteries in quantum mechanics, with the observer effect. And then they even took that another step higher with another split screen experiment, where in order for the results to come out the way they did, the photon of light would actually have to travel back in time in order to find out whether or not it was observed or not. And then it still struck the way it did. So it's definitely a mystery topic. And if I could answer that question, then I would probably be lining up for the next Nobel.
I think one last question is only fitting before we get you out of here. But because our name is Black Hole Theories, what do you theorize happens in a black hole?
Oof. That's where general relativity and quantum mechanics meet, and all of our science breaks down. So I have no answer for that one. I know some people theorize that the opposite end of a black hole is a white hole, but no one has ever detected anything that was just like spitting out ungodly sums of matter into the universe.
What is a white hole?
Who knows? Maybe on an alternative dimension, they have white holes and we have black holes.
Interesting.
I feel like one day we'll definitely find the answer to that question. And by we, I don't mean me, but
I don't want to find out the hard way.
Yeah. I feel like due to the spaghetti stretching effect, you wouldn't even survive the entry.
Well, and they say you would even end up seeing the end of time on the way down.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not dead by then,
right,
from being stretched infinitely long. All right. Well, thank you for that, Christian. Anything else you want to add here?
I appreciate it. This is such a fascinating topic, and I love discussing it. And people have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Yeah. You've been awesome, Gio or Gary. You know, we would love to have you again, you know, sometime on the pod. We really appreciate your time, you know, coming in here and, you know, tackling these crazy topics with us, these black hole theories. And yeah, man. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. And where can people find you on social media?
So, the easiest place to find me is on my author website, Gio Turner Writes, WRITES.com. I'm actually known for writing some fantasy adventure fiction novels, and you can pick up a free copy of one of those at that site. And from there, you can click over to different, you know, social media accounts as well, with Facebook, Twitter, etc.
Cool.
Gio Turner, everyone.